Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Conditional Sale and Patent Rights Edition. I'm your host, Christopher Goffis. On May 30th, 2017, the Supreme Court decided Impression Products, Inc. v. Lexmark International, Inc. Lexmark International, Inc., which owns many patents for its printer toner cartridges, allows customers to buy its cartridges through a return program, which is administered under a combination single-use patent and contract license. Customers purchasing cartridges through the return program are given a discount in exchange for agreeing to use each cartridge once before returning it to Lexmark. All of the domestically sold cartridges at issue here, and some of those sold abroad, were subject to the return program. Impression Products, Inc. acquired some Lexmark cartridges abroad after a third party physically changed the cartridges to enable their reuse in order to resell them in the United States. Lexmark then sued, alleging that Impression had infringed on Lexmark's patents because Impression acted without authorization from Lexmark to resell and reuse the cartridges. Impression contended that its resale of the cartridges was not an infringement because Lexmark, in transferring the title by selling the cartridges initially, granted the requisite authority. The district court granted Impression's motion to dismiss as it related to the domestically sold cartridges, but denied it as to the foreign sold cartridges. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit reversed the district court's judgment as to the domestically sold cartridges, but affirmed dismissal regarding the cartridges sold abroad. There were two questions before the Supreme Court. One, whether a conditional sale that transfers title to the patented item, while specifying post-sale restrictions on the article's use or resale, avoids application of the patent exhaustion doctrine and therefore permits the enforcement of such post-sale restrictions through the patent law's infringement remedy, and two, whether in light of this court's holding in Kurtzsang v. John Wiley & Sons, Inc., that the common law doctrine barring restraints on alienation that is the basis of exhaustion doctrine makes no geographical distinctions, a sale of a patented article authorized by the U.S. patentee that takes place outside the United States exhausts the U.S. patent rights in that article. By a vote of 7-1, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Federal Circuit and remanded the case. In an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, the court held that 1. Lexmark exhausted its patent rights in toner cartridges sold in the United States through its return program, and 2. Lexmark cannot sue Impression Products for patent infringement with respect to cartridges Lexmark sold abroad, which Impression Products acquired from purchasers and imported into the United States, because an authorized sale outside of the United States, just as one within the United States, exhaust all rights under the Patent Act. The Chief Justice's majority opinion was joined by Justices Kennedy, Thomas, Breyer, Alito, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justice Ginsburg filed an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part. Justice Gorsuch took no part in the consideration or decision of this case. And now, to discuss the case, we have Adam Mossoff, who is Professor of Law and Co-Director of Academic Programs and Senior Scholar of CPIP, Antonin Scalia Law School, George Mason University.
For many people who are patent law geeks and have been following the Supreme Court's engagement in patent law, they'll know that this is very much a follow-up decision to the Supreme Court's decision in Quanta Computers versus LG Electronics in 2008, which addressed a very similar and related question pertaining to the ability to impose restrictions on licenses and sales of patented products, but which left open the question as to whether exhaustion was a per se rule or a default presumption that one could contract out of through a conveyance instrument, whether it's an assignment or some other type of conveyance of one's property rights, such as a license. And so I'm going to primarily focus on the domestic aspect of the exhaustion doctrine, because that was, in fact, the most shocking part of the opinion from my perspective, where Chief Justice Roberts hands down an absolute per se rule resolving the confusion left by Quanta that all sales of patented products exhaust all property rights in the product as they pertain to the patent rights that cover it. And in doing so, Chief Justice Roberts invoked this alleged 160-year-old precedent that he said, you know, this is a long-standing rule, this rule of absolute exhaustion, referring and quoting from Chief Justice Roger Taney's decision in Bloomer v. McQueen from 1853. But this is really a shocking claim for him to make, and quite a surprising reference, because patent law historians, myself included, but many others, Sean O'Connor and others, have long recognized that the portion of the opinion to which Chief Justice Roberts cites and relies upon itself was at the time recognized as dicta. It represented a policy-driven agenda by Chief Justice Roger Taney, who anyone who knows him should well know that he had proclivities to engaging in policy-driven agendas in his Supreme Court decisions, not just in patent law, but in other areas of law, including constitutional law. And in fact, it was not based in the law at that time, either in the patent statutes. In fact, it directly conflicted with the patent statutes, as well as it conflicted with longstanding established practices at that time with respect to the commercialization of patented innovation by many people in the antebellum era, including Charles Goodyear's invention of vulcanized rubber, Samuel Morse's invention of the telegraph, Samuel Colt's invention of the repeating firearm, Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin, and so on and so on. So despite the fact that Chief Justice Roberts claims that he is upholding a long-standing 160-year-old rule, he in fact is upending more than 200 years of settled commercialization practices in the innovation economy in the United States in the sale and use of property rights at all points along the value chain, both the production portion of it and the distribution portion of it. Because contrary to Chief Justice Roberts' kind of quaint example of the sale of a car, the fact of the matter is that property owners, particularly real property owners, have imposed restrictions and transferred lesser interests in their property, whether they are restricted covenants or whether they are lesser estates, all the time. In fact, this was the model for what later becomes known as patent exhaustion. In the 19th century, it was not known as patent exhaustion doctrine because this was just how you transferred property rights. And in fact, at the time, the courts repeatedly cited to real property cases and common law and relied upon those in adjudicating and enforcing these types of post-sale restrictions of lesser estate interests of patent rights and patented products in the marketplace. And in fact, they imposed the same doctrinal restrictions from real property that evolved at common law into patent law. And so, for instance, just as the real property market doesn't collapse because people don't know if they're purchasing houses that is less than a full fee simple because there has to be an express writing of those limitations, and there has to be notice, either actual notice or constructive notice. And you saw the exact same restrictions and doctrinal requirements applied in the patent cases all along over through Supreme Court and lower case cases where they recognized that Taney had said, oh yes, the patents are just the right to exclude, so when you sell in the marketplace, you've exhausted your right to exclude. But that was Chief Justice Taney's view of patents as franchise monopoly grants, a view and perspective that Chief Justice Roberts adopts, shockingly, in this opinion. And all the other courts at the time recognized that's not how the patents are actually treated under the patent statutes of the time or under the existing judicial interpretations of the patent statutes, and the fact that they were treated as real property interests and similar to those interests in the extent to which in which property owners had the ability to impose restrictions on the sale of patented products as long as they did so through express language and purchasers and follow-on successors and assigned had notice of those expressly written down restrictions. And so what then happens here in Impression Products is that, and what one notices when one reads the opinion is he quickly jumps, Chief Justice Roberts quickly jumps from this 160-year-old precedent, Bloomer v. McQueen, to reliance upon all of these early 20th century cases. So he relies on Strauss v. Victor talking machines from 1917, the Boston Store of Chicago versus American Gramophone from 1918, the United States versus Univis decision from 1948, which also played a significant role in the Quanta decision back in 2008, the United States versus General Electric decision from 1926, and the Motion Pictures Patents versus Universal Film Manufacturing decision from 1917. Well, what's significant about these six primary precedents that Chief Justice Roberts relies upon is that none of them are patent cases. They are all, in fact, antitrust cases. And so what Chief Justice Roberts ends up doing is invoking this dicta from 1853 and then mixing early 20th century antitrust doctrines with patent law. And in fact, it's even worse because what he's mixing is not even contemporary antitrust doctrines, because the reason why those cases in the early 19-teens, 20s, and 40s reached the decisions that they did was because at that time antitrust had per se rules against these types of restrictions being imposed by businesses who were commercializing their products in the marketplace. And antitrust has since recognized that those rules are inefficient and in fact, not workable, and in fact undermine consumer welfare. And so they've actually shifted to a rule of reason analysis under today's contemporary antitrust doctrine. But instead, what you have is this importation of these now antiquated, abrogated antitrust rules in antitrust of the early 20th century into patent doctrine, and the destruction, therefore, of the very essence of what it means to have a property right, which is that you have the right to commercialize it in the marketplace and freely convey it to other people with whatever restrictions or limitations or slices of the property estate interest that you have, as long as you do so with express written language and that there's notice to all parties, including successors and assigns. So at the end of the day, why have property owners have had these long-standing doctrinal rights to engage in this kind of slicing and dicing of their property interests? It's because this is what achieves economic efficiencies in the marketplace. This is the foundation for a successful and flourishing free market, whether you're talking about a free market in the sale of real property and tangible property interests, or whether you're talking about an innovation economy driven by new inventions and new innovations. In fact, it's very revealing in this case itself that the recipients of the Lexmark toner cartridges who obtained them with the reuse and restyle restrictions that were imposed by Lexmark did so by paying a discount. So they paid less because, of course, just like if you sell a life estate interest in your property and not a full fee simple interest, the person will pay less for it because they're not obtaining the full property, right? The people who obtained these printer cartridges with the resale and reuse restrictions paid less for them because they weren't obtaining a full interest in what they were obtaining. And this is exactly what you want in the marketplace, because this is what makes it possible for companies to efficiently deploy products and services all along the value chain to make them available to people who have price points at very different levels given their conditions in their life, whether they have lower incomes or higher incomes and other types of concerns. And so this has been completely and utterly wiped out foundationally and doctrinally in this decision, where Chief Justice Roberts, invoking this kind of monopoly perspective of patents that Chief Justice Taney had in 1853 as a Jacksonian Democrat, in saying that, nope, when you transfer a patented product to the marketplace as a per se absolute rule, you are now outside the bounds of the exclusive monopoly that's been conferred upon you by the government, and therefore you no longer have the ability to control this. This is the exact opposite view of what patent rights have been in the United States for well over 200 years, and we will actually see the unfortunate consequences of this in the coming years.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.